On today's episode of Born to Know, I'm joined by my dear, dear friend, Dr. Kelly Brogan. As is our usual fashion, we chitty-chat about a lot of topics, some juicy and some really, really juicy. We explore what it means to reclaim our neuroception and understand how we perceive safety and threat at a subconscious level, and how to regain agency over this vital aspect of everyday life. We look at why victim consciousness feels more comfortable than taking responsibility, and how the psychological pull of staying in a victim mindset actually satisfies our body's erotic need to feel wronged. Why do we resist accountability? Because it might mean we no longer have anything to complain about. We look at the paradox of conscious parenting, how many parents position themselves as elevated, awake, and naturally minded, yet inadvertently hold onto deep judgment, polarity, and creating division rather than connection and self-worth for their children. And how to reconnect with the most important relationship in your life, the one you have with yourself. Dr. Brogan shares insights on how to restore self-compassion and authenticity in a world that often feels structured for disconnection and survival. This episode is a must listen for anyone looking to break free from old patterns, reclaim their sense of agency, and cultivate deeper, more pleasurable experiences in this life. Hey, Kelly, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Hey, girl. It is a pleasure to be here with you.
What's going on in your world today?
I don't know if I messaged you about this, but I had a really wild dream actually the other night. And I don't always recall my dreams like vividly. And so this was like super notable, and it felt like some sort of completion ceremony. Okay. So I'm not going to tell you all the details, and nobody wants to hear all the details of a dream, but suffice it to say, it was like the, I don't know, like the sort of subtext to my life experience as a woman, as far as the dramas relationally, I would say specifically the dramas that I've moved through in partnership. And here's the dream. Here's the dream. So I'm in an Uber, and the driver has like this like alluring quality. He reminds me of, you know, the comedian Theo Vaughn.
No, I don't.
Okay. Love him. Anyway, in my world, in my dreamscape, he's like, you know, he has a magnetism. Anyway, so he's kind of like a Theo Vaughn type character. And I get out of the Uber and I forgot my iPhone in the car. So you know that I spent like 2.5 years off of my iPhone. So it's not like, for me, it's like I know how to navigate the world and like without it. So it wasn't like, oh my God, but it was just sort of like, oh my God, this is just, I don't want to deal with this. Like, this is annoying. So then he drives off and it's too late. And I realized like, I can just call the phone. Okay. So I call the phone and he answers. I'm like, oh, sweet. Hey, can you bring this to me? Like, I forgot it in your car. And he's being like cagey and kind of like shady and a bit like manipulative, and he doesn't want to bring it to me, and he wants me to like wait. And I start to feel this feeling in my body that I have experienced many, many, many times before as a woman in the world, of like getting him to do the thing I want him to do, right? It's like, it's almost like a snake charmer energy, which could also be called a manipulative energy, right? Where I want him to do the thing and he's withholding and like mishandling it somehow, right? And so I'm trying to like get him to do the thing for me, but he's like not doing it. So long, you know, dream weirdness story short, I have the phone. Okay. I have the phone. Not only do I have the phone, but I called him from the fucking phone. I have the phone. Okay. And he also knew that.
It's so funny. Pause. I was going to be like, oh, she probably went to a payphone, because there is no time in dreams. So it could have been like 20 years ago. She used a payphone.
I used the very phone that I was like seeking to even reach the guy. Okay. And he knew this, but he was playing along and sort of like messing with me in a way, right? because he could see that I couldn't, I didn't get it that I had the phone. So I woke up and I was like, this is it. Like, I've had the thing the whole time. And I somehow have put male characters in front of me. And this is not just in partnership, by the way, like professionally and otherwise. I've put these male characters in front of me where I get to experience through them like a mishandling and almost like a hide and seek with the thing that I already have. Like, I get to like play pretend that not only do I not have it, but it's being like mishandled and taken, you know, for granted or withheld upon or whatever, you know, insert abusive terminology here. And I swear, like, some sort of spell was broken when I woke up, because I felt like, okay, if I want to keep playing this game in any way, shape, or form, then I can do that. And if not, then I can just walk the world aware that I have the thing already. It's like very, very fucking deep experience that I had in my nocturnal realm. And it dovetails with like some other real life experiences that I've had of like, even just, you know, in the book publishing world, like just in the mundane arenas of life where there's just like little conflicts that I, you know, feel somewhat victimized by, that I see I co-created so that I could have this experience of my precious thing being mishandled. It was actually like, yeah, quite delightful to see that.
Super delightful. And like, what's the part of you that gets that pleasure, right? If we're like thinking of fetishes, which is one of the things in your book, The Reclaimed Woman, that really tickled me, because, you know, like, I'm always like, what's no, pun intended. And yeah, like, what is the fetish behind feeling that we're being mishandled? And like, you know, that's obviously like the victim role that we're playing, but like, what does that fetish look like? Because I mean, every woman that I encounter seems to have some version of it in varying degrees. But like, what are we getting from feeling that sense of mishandling?
This is the million-dollar question. I mean, I know that there is like a sensory dimension to this, right? And you know this well too. Like, there's a sensory dimension, and I could feel it in the dream. Like, I could feel my whole system like aroused by the prospect of getting him to do the thing or see my perspective or cooperate or collaborate or get on my team, right? So I got to feel like my potential power to, you know, create this version of reality. And so had I succeeded, there would have been, I guess, some sort of a feeling of like, yeah, I got it, you know? And in the not succeeding, there's still the pursuit, right? There's still this sort of like the efforting, the longing even. And so that sensory roller coaster is obviously super familiar to my system. I get to play all sorts of archetypes, like the damsel, like the seductress. Like, I get to try on all these different dimensions of myself, not consciously necessarily. But I've noted, you know, in the past couple of years of my non-dating celibate life, single woman life, I've noticed that the sobriety I have come to experience as my my normal these days isn't just about, you know, plant medicines and booze. It's largely about the addiction cycle relationally. And again, yes, this is most relevant to the romantic arena, but I've seen it translated, let's say, into the business realm, entrepreneurship realm for me pretty seamlessly, right? So like, I might not have been playing out these dynamics with a partner, but I certainly had plenty of material for me to re-experience the disappointment and the resentment and the feeling of like, nobody's here for me. Why do I have to do it all by myself? Kind of a thing. So in these years, what I've been working toward in my relaxed woman moment is just expanding my capacity for relaxation, for ease, for harmony. I mean, there's very, very few spikes at this point in my system. And there is a way to read that as boring, as, you know, even worse, like a kind of nihilistic, like hopelessness, like there's a futility to my life, right? Like these are all the ways that like peace and stability has been tagged in my system as actually like something to be suspicious of and something to be like nonetheless vigilant around. So I think that we take the stimulation, we take the arousal, like in whatever form we can get it, in whatever form, I'll speak for myself, in whatever form I can get it, that especially if it feels like a familiar, like dynamic arc, right? Like, you know, I offer the thing and then, you know, he takes the thing and then he does the something wrong with the thing and then I get upset and then I need to get him to do the right thing with the thing. It's like, you know, it's like a whole dance. It is really, it's like a choreographed dance. And I just saw the anatomy of it in that dream so clearly, such that I felt left with a choice. Like I felt left with sort of the appreciation for like why that might be fun. You know, like Alan Watts talks about that. Like you incarnate here to play hide and seek with your own awareness, with your own consciousness. It's thrilling on some level. It's not like a bad primitive thing I'm doing, you know, it's just how I might have wanted to remember and re-experience like the native wholeness, you know, that's always been here with me, you know, that certainly has felt easy to forget at many, many points in the journey.
Yeah. And it's interesting to note, like, as that dance is going on and unfolding, I've had these like moments of lucidity where I'm like watching myself do the thing. And I'm even like, I'm in a micro choice moment where I'm like, I could stop right now. And then I just don't. And then I'm like, you know, and sometimes I do. And I wonder, like, I don't know how this works. This is not my arena. Like, is a component of it like hormonal, chemical, that's in air quotes. What's the physical addiction apart from like the memory or the familiarity of it from maybe childhood experiences? Like, is there something else happening that's like keeping us super addicted to this?
Yeah. I mean, you and I both have come to question so much of what I learned in, you know, in as a neuroscience major and then a psychiatrist and, you know, somebody deeply interested in the, you know, catecholamine hypothesis of so-called mental health. However, like all you need to do is appreciate the addictive nature of coffee, which you and I discuss on the regular, to know, right? Like, so what happens when you drink coffee? We could break it down into the compounds and say, well, the caffeine is stimulating your, you know, adrenergic system and you're getting that sort of fight, flight, rev, except there's also a mysterious pleasure component, right, that labels that revving positive, right? And so you can see in the addictive nature of coffee, which I think is probably one of the most addictive foods, plants out there, whatever that means. And that's not to be like put a pejorative label on it. It's just to acknowledge that there's something mysterious that goes on. And a big part of what goes on there is this, the literal arousal of your system. So, you know, if you can look at extreme anxiety, and then you look at like extraordinary excitement and you consider the arousal patterns, like the somatic sequence, they're extremely similar, yeah. Right? So like the racing heart, maybe like a little bit of sense of flushing. For me, I always have like this upward energy, like goes up my neck. And the only difference is how you are labeling it, right? So like, I've used this simple example. So let's say you're like a hot girl, and let's just say you're a hot girl, okay? Just for
just for now
purposes. You're walking down an alleyway in New York at night by yourself, okay? And you hear these footsteps coming up behind you. What's going to happen? Your entire system is going to release like a pharmacopoeia of stuff that we're trying to quantify that is probably largely unquantifiable. And as a result, your heart's going to start racing. You might start breathing more quickly. You might tense up certain muscles. You might start having images, like intrusive images of what might be about to happen to you, you know, assault and capture or whatever. And let's say all of a sudden you hear a voice from those footsteps and the voice is your friend's voice. What's going to happen? That entire cascade is going to reverse, right? So you might even laugh to discharge the energy. And the only thing that has changed is you have narrated the perception in that micro moment differently. And so that's why this notion of perception, right? Like if that is the lens of reality that we are gazing through, and if it determines our physiologic state, then where do we enter, right? Like, do we enter through the physiology and, you know, try to calm and soothe our nervous system down? Or do we play with this idea of perception? How do we play with that, right? Like, what does that even mean? And even with that dream I told you about, like, that's what felt like the gift of the dream is I woke up with enhanced perception of what the fuck is going on or might have historically gone on, right? And it's more than just saying like, I'm here to learn my spiritual lessons, you know, and like, I'm doing this stupid shit. And that's just part of being a human. Like the play of perception, it's like virtual reality goggles. Like it is the game you're electing to play because there is an experience, an embodied experience that you get to have as a result. And so, you know, like in psychobiology, it's called neuroception, right? So there's literally a term for how you can perceive safety in your environment. And it has to do with assessing. So interoception has to do with assessing your inner landscape for signs and signals, and then assessing the outer landscape. And you merge and fuse that inner and outer perception to generate an experience of reality that is just your own. And so that's why, you know, I've come to see that as, you know, like, how do we, I want to say, you know, reclaim neuroception? Like, how do we get to the place where our neuroception is sober, right? Is somehow, if this is even the goal, drained of all of the potentially distorting elements that would divorce us from what's actually in front of us, so that we can't, like, so that I'm calling the Uber driver on the phone that I'm insisting he has. You know, like, it's so on the nose.
I mean, to reclaim neuroception feels like it would actually get us closer to what we want, which is to discharge the pain, to be farther away from pain, to be farther away from the discomfort and the confusion, and walk more towards expansion and pleasure. Like, we could say that there's infinite ways, but that's the end game, right? It's like, how do I feel more ease and pleasure? But the flip side of reclaiming this neuroception makes me think of ways in which we also convince ourselves that we are safe. Do we start to shut down what the body is trying to tell us in order to be able to be in something because we feel like I've convinced myself now that this is good? Like, it starts to get really murky, right? And then we get into the terrain of self-betrayal. But it's like, is that the other side of it, of that power?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think that self-gaslighting is ultimately the only gaslight, right? So when you recognize that this is not possible for somebody to, right? Like, again, this stupid dream, but it wouldn't be possible for him to gaslight me and say, I have your phone, if I wasn't also participating in gaslighting myself in that moment. And it can, as you're suggesting, it can, you know, sort of spiral in two directions. One, to suggest that I'm actually in a kind of danger that I'm not, right? And another is to suggest that I'm actually way more okay than my biology is suggesting. Right. So in both polarities, there is a misattunement to the self, right? To the embodied self, but then also to what the hell is actually happening. And so I don't really know what the goal is per se, because like when most of us think about, like, you know, if you think about living this like endless, blissful, pleasurable, stimulating, fun, adventurous life, at least for me, that actually doesn't sound super appealing, right? And, you know, call me, you know, a drama queen, unrecovered. I don't know. But it's also, not to like reference Alan Watts repeatedly, but, you know, he has this lecture where he talks about like, what if you could dream your own dreams? Like, he didn't use the phrase lucid dreams, but he was talking about, you know, like, if you could make your dream whatever the hell you want, maybe the first night you have sex with all the beautiful women or men, and you have all the incredible food, and you go on all these like wild adventures, and maybe you have like a new twist on it the next night. But then by the third night, you're like inserting a little bit of like an unexpected, you know, surprise. And then by the seventh night, you're like, whatever, how about we just go back to what it was, where I'm not actually like, it, you know, consciously in charge of this. And so I think that that is a huge part of the game, is not actually being in full conscious control, right? Like when I rest into the possibility that there is an aspect, a layer of destiny to my life experience, that my whole system relaxes. You know, when the money, the man, the house, the relationship, the beauty, the whatever is like already written, I'm just at the movies, you know, a movie that I'm like, you know, starring in, and there's no point to me exerting effort to try and like get the characters to do a thing. It's already written. It's already happening. So why don't I just, you know, show up to whatever is occurring for my own experiential enjoyment. And just like any movie, that can include like blood and gore and loss. And, you know, that doesn't make it a shitty, negligible movie. It makes it even better movie, right? So we want there to be that contrast, that experience of the fuller range of emotional energies. But I do think that the gaslight is, it's almost like built in. It's like built into the experience. And I don't think that it's even necessarily something to, you know, valorize, to like say, okay, well, I see every single thing clearly. Probably never. That, you know, that will probably never actually happen. It's probably not even possible. And waking up from a gaslight, it feels a certain kind of grounded way. It feels orienting, and it feels like you get a little bit of your vital force back in your body. And the more aliveness, right? Like if I were to say there's like some sort of goal for me experientially, it's just to feel more and more alive. It's not necessarily to feel more pleasure. Do I want to feel alive on a spectrum of conflict, tension, drama, litigation, you know, screaming, yelling, whatever? Or do I want to feel alive on the expansive, you know, joy, ecstasy, bliss, eros side of things? Or do I want to feel some blend of all of them? Do I want to just like go out for a walk in my neighborhood and just feel like so infused with whatever is available to me, just looking around at the trees? Like, I don't know. I would rather it be as non-contingent as possible on things I can't control at all, right? That snake charmer feeling of like, I'm going to get the people to do the things I want them to do, is a codependent like nightmare, actually. And so once you've had enough of that, then you sort of feel like, okay, well, I'm going to play with the pieces I can play with and see how clearly I can perceive what is actually beneficial to me, my yes, and what is actually potentially problematic for me in terms of like, you know, conflict, tension, a feeling of separateness, you know, which is the no. And ignoring that no is, as far as I can tell, the most rapid route of entry into that side of the spectrum. You know, when you feel that little no, when you're like on a date, or when you're interviewing, you know, an employee, or when you're, you know, agreeing to some sort of family event. You feel that little no and you ignore it because you say, oh, it's fine. Like, I'll make it work. It's good enough. It's like you've bought yourself a ticket to a certain spectrum of experience that is probably going to be super familiar. That's going to be arousing in that particular way I described. And I guess we just do that until it's not interesting anymore.
Of course, I see this, like what you just illustrated, come up so much in the birth space. It's like so many options, choices available, right? And women very often elect certain pathways simply because, you know, they want to please their partner, their family. They have a type of dynamic with their medical provider, whoever it is, where they feel that they're being expected to say yes or no to certain things. And so a lot of women say, you know, I tried to access that no, like I didn't really like what was presented to me, but I didn't trust that I knew the answer enough to take the other choice. You know, like I don't actually trust in that benevolent being or that energy that I can fall back into. How can a woman discern, you know, and how can she say, well, I don't actually know about that thing, but I'm going to walk towards it maybe for the first time. Like, how does she contend with that? Is it about titrating in? Is it about saying like, okay, maybe saying, you know, yes to the free birth or the home birth or whatever it is just way too much for my system. Like, how do they titrate into those kinds of things? Or is it just about jumping over the edge, seeing what happens?
What I can say about that is relaxing the habit of needing to explore beyond the no is the first step. Now, what I mean by that is when you feel the no, and usually it's not like it's like just like a little tap. It's like, I like to say it's like a nope, 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 not for me. Just stop there and see if that's something that you have the wherewithal to express. This doesn't feel good. I don't like this. I want to feel more of this or that or whatever. Because once you internally start to figure out what the yes is, once you try to solve the problem inside of yourself, you're already in the self-abandonment terrain. So I'll give a mundane example. I did this podcast. We were actually going to do another podcast to talk about it because it was such a meta experience with Emily Fletcher. And it was in Topanga. I don't know what time of year it was, but obviously, you know, we're in Miami. My lovely body is used to a certain kind of vibe. And this was a very long form podcast and I wore a silk dress. Okay. So it was levels of freezing that I have not experienced because their heater was broken and they had like tripped a wire or whatever and lost footage just the day before. And so there was an experience I was having in my body during this podcast that was largely about self-betrayal. And I'm sitting here like literally like teeth chattering, trying to come across like some like, you know, like I have any idea what I'm talking about or I know anything about embodiment. And my teeth are chattering. I am totally freezing, completely uncomfortable. And all I had to do in that moment was say, oh, there's also a man in the room, by the way, like a problem solving, helping, fixing guy. Okay. So all I had to say was, hey guys, I'm freezing. This is not working for me. But instead, I did the other thing you're describing. I said, okay, I tried to solve the problem in my mind. So I was like, they can't put a heater on because it's going to blow this fuse. And I didn't bring a sweater. And there's nowhere else in this house that we could record. So I couldn't figure out how to solve the problem in my head. And I'm like a pretty good problem solver, which is in many ways a handicap in this situation, right? So I couldn't figure out how to solve it. And so therefore I didn't say anything. But if I live in a world where solving all the problems, and specifically my problems, is up to me, then I don't ever get to enjoy what it is to receive, to be taken care of, to have people experience their own competency and masteries and their own problem solving, right? We know how good it feels to help somebody with their problem, right? And to put heads together and whatever. So I couldn't solve it myself, so I decided it was unsolvable. I've learned, you know, and I know you have as well, that specifically, I mean, we are amazing problem solvers as women, but I actually think men solve problems differently in a way that's extremely advantageous to us as women, right? So if I had put this challenge into that guy's hands, I am like pretty certain that he could have come up with something so that my body could have felt more comfortable for the remaining, you know, 90 minutes of this experiment. Okay. And I didn't do that. I didn't do that. And it was like a real, one of several like neon light lessons for me. So I would say if you can resist or relax the impulse to figure out the alternative when you're feeling a no, then the expression of your no does not come with any validation. It doesn't come with an explanation. It doesn't come with its own solution. It's simply, this is how I'm feeling about this. Right? And sometimes it's really uncomfortable not to have the alternative option, you know, standing ready for you to claim. In fact, I would say that that is the most difficult aspect of honoring your little no, is that sometimes it's just like a very pregnant pause. And it feels like you might relinquish something or lose something that you're not going to easily replace. You know, but that allegiance, I think, is part of the homecoming. And it's also part of the avoidance of an extraordinary amount of drama and the perception that everything is like a duality, or like this, just it's the dichotomous choice. It's like this or that. There's almost always some other creative option, but it's not going to make manifest until and if you can own your own orientation towards the situation.
Right. Like just hold the discomfort of not having the solution and allowing for the possibility that someone else who you're dancing with or engaging with might have a solution, you know? And I guess this is always what I end up saying in the end to them is like, well, you don't know what to do. The only thing to do is just say it doesn't work. You walk out and give yourself, I don't know, a few days, a few hours, a week, like nothing needs to get decided. And that's a big thing too, right? It's like when you don't know what to do, just do nothing, right? Or is this an impulse to solve the problem? But I guess that fear that I mentioned earlier in my question of like, well, they know better because I don't know the answer. I think what it really means is what you said is I don't have a solution on deck and I can't deal with that.
Yeah, it's too uncomfortable. And so, yeah, that's, yeah. A lot of this comes down to what you can capacitate literally in your system.
So we have to give ourselves these opportunities to expand that capacity. And that might just be by simply expressing or even acknowledging, identifying, and perhaps expressing, even if you're like alone in your room, like this doesn't feel good right now. Right. And even that is an opportunity to start walking towards, you know, a more embodied experience, more loyalty to oneself, simply acknowledging that something doesn't feel good, rather than giving yourself 21 reasons why you should probably figure out a way to just make it work.
You mentioned titration, and I do think that there is a role for that if we're talking about nervous system and somatic expansion, right? So, you know, maybe like standing up and saying like, this is a no for me, right? Like it's just like way beyond what your system is ever going to be ready for. And so you're going to collapse around that opportunity every single time. But, you know, maybe a titration into that comportment towards your life and yourself is to say like, hey, can I have a minute? Like I need a minute, right? And just like insert a pause, you know, where there otherwise would have been some kind of action in a direction. And even that, you know, might feel like too much for a certain system. And so there's an even smaller step where you can begin to explore allowing something to like kind of marinate instead of committing before you are actually clear.
One of the things that was happening before our call today was that my client who's abroad was like, oh, I went to the appointment and they don't like the way things look and they want me to just stay here. Like I came for a prenatal appointment and they just want me to stay here and they want to induce me. And I was like, okay, what does it feel like to do that? She's like, horrible. I said, well, what does it feel like to just go home and eat and like take a nap and then maybe like think about it tomorrow? She's like, oh, you know, I don't have to decide right now. And I was like, no, I mean, no, like they might call you, ask you, you know, but you could just stay in your car. Or you could just turn it on and turn around and drive home. You know, you don't actually have to go back into the office. And all it's offering is a pause, you know, and who knows what's possible when we live in a pause for some time. When it feels like everything is resting on that decision, maybe it's a good idea to just not take any action. You know, I think that in itself is a really beautiful practice. This is something that, you know, we've talked about the Cartman drama triangle. It's something that you bring up in the book. And I started to reflect on the ways in which my journey as like a single mother at the time, I was like, oh my God, I'm just oscillating between all three of these roles, like constantly. Oh, like I'm so done with this story, you know, like how do I actually reclaim pleasure in my motherhood experience, like in this journey? You know, like, how do I stop with the story that like, it has to be hard because like somehow like society, I mean, we could go into like why there's this ascribed definition, you know, to single motherhood, or I can create spaciousness, or I can do this, or I can do this. And I started to personally transform how I was approaching that time with my daughter, my perception of her presence in my life, like my perception of what pleasure means when I'm interacting with her. I came into contact with parts of myself because I always said, like, I can't do imaginative play. Like my whole system would shut down when she wanted to play because I had no framework for what that even looked like. And so my whole system would shut down. I'd get sleepy. Like I would actually feel like I needed coffee in order to like pretend to be a fairy princess and like whatever it was. And so as I started to say like, okay, I'm going to give myself 10 minutes of like really feeling what it is to be like at her level and like not having the phone nearby, not engaging in this and like creating more time for myself to be in that. And then noticing when like I'd reached my limit, I was able to expand my capacity to just engage in that quality time. And needless to say, it was a long journey and, you know, it took time, but I finally got to a place where like, there is nothing victim-y about raising my child. And I know that like many people might be like, yeah, of course, like it's a blessing. I know that it is, but like we all have to admit that there's a level to that role that maybe we want to acknowledge or not, where we feel victimized. What does that mean to reclaim that motherhood experience? Because I know you've had some beautiful experiences with your daughters over the last few years and like created space for trips and like created space to allow them to be who they are. Like that's a big one too. Like coming from the health community, I was like, you know, homeschooling her, breastfed her till she was 5. But I was also like, no, you can't eat this. No, you can't do that. No, you can't, like controlling the experience so much that I was like basically the helicopter mom that I was condemning.
I mean, just like on that note, I mean, I love, this is my favorite topic. And on that note, you and I have talked about how, and I'm sure your audience is familiar enough with German New Medicine principles to know that this is probably one of the reasons why so many holistic parents have kids with tooth issues. Like literally every holistic family that I know has kids with like teeth rotting out of their freaking mouth.
Everybody wants to blame the breast milk and like the no fluoride toothpaste. Like that's where everyone lands.
Right. Or like they're not enough Western price dieting or whatever. But from a German New Medicine perspective, it's like not, you know, they can't like bite into their own lives because they have these domineering edicts and tenets that they must live by. And so much of it is that good, bad split, right? It's like, you will get love if you conform to my health-oriented expectations around tech or food or beliefs, you know, which expand beyond health, as you and I know well, into like truthing, right? And you're not allowed to think that, you know, the presidential race is real. You have to know that this is all bullshit or whatever. And yeah, I mean, I was pretty steeped in a narrative about my mothering that only allowed for me to be the heroine, right? So I was only allowed to be the savior in the triangle. Okay. I was only allowed to see myself as the one who was ending all of these cycles because, you know, I'm raising these pharma-free kids on organic gluten-free diet. And, you know, they are going to get handed down all the truths that I so painstakingly acquired in my system. And they get to come to ecstatic dance with me, and they get to, you know, I unschooled them for, I guess, a year and a half or so. And so they get to, you know, have this free range experience. I was probably at the peak of this psychology then, you know, obviously during the pandemic and everything else. And the first opportunity that I had to allow for a little tear in the screen of that version of the movie, right? Was when, I don't know where I got these prompts from, but I decided to, because I'm always like, I'm like an experience junkie, as are you. And like, I love to, I'm just going to fucking try it. So I was like, I'm going to try and ask my kids this question. Okay. And one of the questions was, is there anything that I have done that you still feel upset about when you think about it? Okay. And the other question was, is there anything that you need from me that I'm not giving you right now? And so I asked my girls this, and I actually asked them how they, you know, I was like, hey, I have these like questions that I want you to think about. Do you want me to like write them down for you or whatever? So they wanted to do it by writing. And so I had the luxury of, you know, like a little bit of private processing time before I expected my system to handle this. And what one of my daughters came back with in response to the first question was a narrative, her narrative, around the prior, let's say like 5 or so, 6 years of the dissolution of our family, that actually painted me as the villain. Right? Like I was the reason. I was selfish and I was, you know, destroyed everything and I did this and I did that. It was not only devastating to like hear that, it was actually like the end of my story that I'm a good mom, right? Like, so I had to confront what I would argue, and I'm sure you would agree, is most mothers' deepest fear that we've done it wrong, like deeply wrong. Not just like fucked up once or here, like the whole, we're just a failure in this, the whole thing, in what we arguably incarnated to experience as a woman, you get an F. Okay. So I spent that night like, just like in the throes of anguish. It was the end of a chapter for me. And I knew, because of my obsession with, you know, victim dynamics, I knew that there was an opportunity here for me to shut the fuck up. Because, you know, I have like litigator level capacity to argue my case. And I could have really sat down and made the agenda of that little sit down. I'm going to get you to see what really happened. Okay. You have no idea how awesome my performance has been. Okay. On your behalf, no less. So instead, I also remembered that like when we're kids, we don't give a shit about our parents' story. Literally nobody cares about your version of the story. Okay. When you're a kid, nobody wants to know their parents' version. I'm sorry. I will die on that hill. That's just how it is. And my daughters are curious and compassionate and like deeply empathetic, and they still do not care about my version of the story. To this day, there's only been like a peppering of questions that I've ever been asked, you know, when I give them the opportunity to ask questions, clarifying what the hell's gone on over the course of their life. Okay. So I sat down with her and essentially I said, tell me more. It was the most demanding thing I have ever asked of my nervous system, period. Hands down. And that's saying a lot because I've had some extremely challenging conversations in my life. And I sat down and I said, tell me more. And I listened and I didn't say anything about my version of the story. And it was like, I was like breathing, you know, I was like feeling my spine. I was like feeling my butt in the chair, you know, my feet on the ground. And literally within 48 hours after that, she expressed like a degree of affection towards me, like physical affection towards me that I hadn't, it hadn't been like our thing really prior. And that began, it like opened up like a new, I don't know, like vista for us in our intimacy, in our relationship. And it was the beginning of the end of like, I know better how this is going to go down. I'm going to control the narrative and you are going to see me a certain way. You're going to give me this kind of respect or whatever, honoring. And that actually was the breaking of the cycle, not the organic food, not, you know, the vax-free life, like that. Showing up for her reality, investing myself in her reality instead of putting and positioning mine as the default that she has to get with. Otherwise, there's going to be loss of love. And, you know, what ensued and has in the following years has been an ever more humbling journey into always staying on my daughter's team. Their teams, you know, like just always, always. Doesn't matter how annoyed I am, how, you know, much I disagree, how disappointed I might feel, like whatever the spectrum of like, you know, I don't like how you're being yourself might show up. It's my job to hold those feelings. It is not their job to make me feel better. And so that has delivered us to this place where we don't have conflicts, you know, like I have teenagers. And so I am like rewriting that whole narrative about like what it is to have rebellious teenage girls and how difficult it is and whatever. And it also requires that so when I first decided I was going to allow them to eat what they would like to eat, by the way, also they make their own money and they go buy whatever the hell they want. So like what illusion was I under that I had any control over what the hell they eat? Okay. So once I let that go, which was probably the biggest one for me because I was so in that rigid, immature, masculine mode with myself and with them that like you need to eat a certain way. Once I let that go, I would still like pepper in some snarky comments. One of them might have like a zit or something. And I'd be like, oh, I guess it wasn't that pizza you had yesterday, you know, kind of a thing, right? Like I would still be doing that. And then, you know, I was called out on even that. And so it's been, again, like suppressing that, like, I'm going to get you to see that I was right, you know, sort of a thing. Has culminated in me relaxing my own food laws, right? So that now I can't even be totally right about how it should be even for me. So I'm in this like watery place of just being with them without an agenda. And it's extremely disorienting, right? Because my whole experience of them always had, like, I even used to tell them these stories. I used to make up these stories when they were little, especially my eldest, called Coco and Yaya, right? Like, I would just make up these stories. And I would make up these stories, but they'd always have, like, a moral to the story, right? Like, something I was trying to, like, get her to, like, learn or see or whatever. And that impulse, that agenda to make sure you're putting them on the good path, the right path, and in our case, like the true path. It's felt, and it's felt as manipulation. And I do think at this point that like the true guidance comes from maintaining the connection, right? Which requires that I contain myself emotionally. Okay. And through the maintenance of the connection, there is a kind of patterning, right? Around whatever I think and believe and think is right and good, whatever. It just gets like transmit it. You know, I don't know. And I don't have to teach the thing. I don't have to be the coach and the, you know, and the lecturer, and their education is not necessary. I mean, I'm not homeschooling, so it's not a pedagogy. And I'm sure it's even more, this challenge becomes even more nuanced when you are homeschooling your own kids. You know, for me, honoring their desire to be in charge of their own lives as teenagers meant that they are both going to schools that I 1000% do not otherwise advocate for. And it's extremely challenging. And especially when I find myself like needing to like make a point or punish the school somehow. But then I remember like it's their choice. Everyone's choosing here. This is all like realm of free consent, and it's their journey, right? Like their battles are not the same as my battles. Thank God, you know, like for whatever decent reasons, like they didn't incarnate to have the like Joan of Arc sword aloft experience of like what it is to navigate the world as a woman. I think that's probably good news, you know? So it's been, it's been mostly humbling. And the other thing I would add is like, as you know, because you were ahead of me on this path, like when I chose to get like literally sober, and to stop drinking like socially, and that's not because I had any real perceptible consequences. And in fact, I had like only this sort of like, you know, it's fun to celebrate, you know, with my girlfriends out at dinner, and maybe I'll have a tequila while I'm cooking. And when I stripped that layer, that seemingly benign layer away, I got to feel so many subtle, so many subtle dimensions of like the irritability, the resentment. Like I actually don't enjoy cooking for y'all, like feeling that was underneath there and well veiled by this like simple recreational pleasurable thing. Okay. And I had to look at that and be with that and deal with that. And a lot of the subtext was like, you know, this experience of being a single mom actually sucks. And I feel really bad for myself. And this is really overwhelming. And I'm running this business and I got to do the dishes and the laundry and drive them around. And like, fuck no, you know? And as I turned towards that, instead of like subtly medicating it, I guess, masking it quietly, that is when I shifted from this I can do it all, you know, assumption to the recognition that I can only align with my actual choices and priorities at this point. I chose to have these children, okay, and I have not yet chosen motherhood, because I have been insisting that choosing my career and choosing motherhood are somehow a simultaneous experience that I can offer myself. And that was a massive gaslight, as I know you know, for so many years of my life. And once I said, you know what? My career is officially on the denouement. My career is officially like entering into its, you know, phases of quiescence and retirement. And it is not my priority to grow this thing any longer. In the sort of like, see me, understand me, look at me, so subtle like validation seeking energy that I had brought to my public facing career. Once that shifted for me, I started to experience doing the dishes and driving them. That was a huge one. As like devotional, as like, this is for them. I actually want to do this. It feels good to me to devote myself to our intimate connection, because, you know, my relationship with my daughters is probably the closest experience of, to intimacy, like true intimacy I will have in this lifetime. So like, I'm sorry, what the fuck is more important than that? And that that's not the same as like serving my kids and like kid-led parenting or whatever the hell kind of like narcissistic extension cloaked as empowering your kids vibe is. It's all literally because this is where the joy in my life is most readily accessed. So why don't I like properly invest in that and actually like walk the walk of what I'm saying my priorities are?
I had what I would probably call like a near-death experience. It's what it felt like when I took Combo, that frog thing. And I mean, I remember looking at my daughter's father and saying like, it's time for me to go. And the only thing I could think about for those, what, like, I don't even know, it feels like an eternity, but it's like 6 minutes, was like a replay of my, you know, first 5 years with my daughter that I had experienced. And like, all I wanted in that moment was to know, like, I saw that the only true intimacy I'd ever experienced was like being pregnant with her, birthing her, and engaging with her. And like, it's all that mattered. Everything else fell away. Like, and I remember saying, from this point on, I'm going to dedicate myself to getting rid of that feeling of sleepiness when I'm engaging with her. I'm going to do whatever it takes to be able to devote myself to this. And that was actually, I mean, I don't even know why I engaged with that medicine to begin with. It was just like experimenting, but that's what I gleaned from it, was that I wanted to devote myself to this experience and step out of the victim who felt like the martyr, right? It's like, I was like, I made some transition from like martyr to devotee. And all I can say is that it's become my compass, right? Like, my relationship with her has become my compass, and it is what gives me the most pleasure. So to hear you say this is like, it really resonates. It's so beautiful, really.
Totally. And you've defied like the like collective like reflex to normalize that, like falling asleep, you know, wanting to fall asleep. That is, it's a trauma response, right? Like, when you think your kid is boring, you're carrying on a legacy of maternal infant trauma, okay? And if you choose to normalize that and to be like, oh, hashtag mom guilt, like, this is it's an indication that you're reverberating with the energy of like your own experience of disassociation and disconnection from your mother and probably her mom. And right. So it's this mother line of association with danger, like that intimacy brings. And I think just what you said, like just saying, I'm not going to stop here, right? Like, I'm not going to like rest in the like, oh, this is how it is for me, so hard and I hate playing or whatever, which I totally relate to. You said like, there's something more that I can access here, and I'm going to make that my North Star, you know, that I'm going to be guided by. Like, who even knows how you unpack it? But you will find a way if you align your priorities with what your native priorities actually are. And I would argue that for mothers, it's always going to be that, okay? Like, it's not an accident that you had this kid, no matter how much of an accident you might be telling yourself it was in certain circumstances. Like, you are having this experience, you chose this experience, and now get right with that priority. Because if you tell yourself, you know, anything else is your priority, you're going to be ultimately confronted with the hollowness of the fulfillment, right? Especially in the career realm, the fulfillment that's on offer.
Yeah, somehow that hungry ghost seems so much more appealing or important, you know, and like the role of mother is like in the shadow to that. And guess what? I know you know this, like many women I've talked to are like, yeah, one of my deepest regrets is like literally not being available for my child and having somebody else raise them. But in the moment we feel that it's the only option we have, but you know, I would beg them to do what we were talking about earlier, which is to create space and put a pause into that whole situation to see what's possible and available, you know, and lean into the discomfort of the unknown, you know, of choosing the other thing, seeing what that really feels like to try it on. Well, as usual, just eternally grateful for your wisdom and for always being available to just peel the curtain back. There's always so much there.